Hey, folks, and welcome to the podcast. This week's episode is a rebroadcast of an interview that I did with Billy Hinchey, and we are playing it because, unfortunately, Billy Hinchey has just passed away of cancer at age 70. Interesting because I feel like I just saw him. He was hosting this very kind of relaxed interview show that he would air live on Facebook, and I watched an episode of it, I feel like just a couple of weeks ago, so it's just strange that he's gone now. He was a longtime touring member of the Beach Boys, and before that he was in the Bandino, Desi, and Billy. His parents, he grew up in the Philippines. His parents moved to Beverly Hills when he was just a little kid, and he met his neighbors, Dino, who is Dean Martin's son, and Desi, who was Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz's son. And the three of them started a sort of a garage band, I guess, that of course, you know, got signed to a record label, and made some fairly interesting hit records. And I think maybe it was as an opening act of the Beach Boys that they met, Billy met the rest of the Beach Boys and ended up becoming part of their touring band for years and years and years. And even recently has still been touring as part of Brian Wilson's band from time to time. Multi-instrumentalist, played keyboard, bass, guitars on the road with the band, sang some songs, including sometimes he would sing Sail on Sailor. So just an interesting music business figure, for sure. I want to also point out, since we're talking Beach Boys, that I've just seen this week the new Brian Wilson documentary, and I totally recommend it. Just very sweet, very interesting. Not perfect, but totally worth watching, I think. And, of course, the archives at WFMU.org/Michael are full of Beach Boy-related interviews. There's Mike Love, Brian Wilson, Al Jardine, David Marks, Hal Blaine, Rocky Pamplin, John Cousill, Ron Altbeck, Carol Kay, Blondie Chapman, Carly Munoz, David Marks, and then a lot of Beach Boys authors who've, you know, written books related to Beach Boys. So if you're a Beach Boys fan, check there. And just sad to lose Billy Hinchey. From all reports, he was just the nicest guy in the world, so he'll be missed.
Yeah, there's I'm a Fool from Dino, Desi, and Billy, wrapping up a really incredible set there of music featuring our guest, Billy Hinchey. Billy, I believe, joins us on the telephone. Billy, are you there?
I am, in fact, here.
Thank goodness. Happy to hear from you. I know it's early where you are, though, so thank you for waking up early.
It's okay. I'm an early riser, as it is, so it's perfect.
Good. I'm a Fool. What a fantastic song. Is that you double-tracked on the lead vocals there?
No, it's actually, well, in a sense, it's Dino and I sharing the vocal in unison, and then double-tracked.
Two-part unison, double-tracked.
Yeah.
It's kind of that signature Dino, Desi, and Billy sound there, you know? It sounds like guys having fun.
Yeah, it was really great fun. I mean, you know, being so young and having an opportunity to record and everything was amazing. I mean, that was really what we wanted. I mean, we just wanted to have a little band, you know? And I think a lot of young people at that time, young guys, wanted to have a little band, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And that was the essence of it. We didn't really think of a recording career or anything. We just wanted to play and play music, and then we started getting hired around town to play at people's parties, birthday parties or whatever, and it was when Jeannie Martin called Frank Sinatra to come hear us that you know, the record deal aspect of it came into play.
So from the beginning, you didn't say, let's start a band and get signed to a record label. It was just, let's start a band and pursue our sort of interest in music and have some fun around the neighborhood?
Exactly. I mean, we didn't even think, you know, basically, you know, I was exposed to music at an early age. My dad in particular encouraged my sister and I to learn a musical instrument, so we both took up piano quite early. And so I had a background in music from a performance standpoint. I mean, even though the performance was at home, you know.
No, it's interesting because some folks have no music in their house growing up. You know, it's not even part of their...
Right.
Their thing. You were born in the Philippines and moved to Beverly Hills at what age?
Three.
Age three. And so you're studying piano at what age?
Three.
Oh, that is early.
I think there are tapes of me, and not tapes, actually, there are discs. My father had the foresight to make, I guess, the equivalent of what we would call acetates way back then. I mean, you could record and make records back in, let's see, the early 50s. Well, I was born 51. And I think I started even back in the Philippines in Manila taking basic piano lessons. But then when we moved to California, then I really got more musical training. Of course, I was older. My dad bought a piano for me. And I took up an interest in violin at age 7. And
when did you see the guitar and go, I need one of those?
Well, when we used to take trips to Hawaii, and I learned to play ukulele, this beautiful woman who taught hula dancing and ukulele lessons at the Hawaiian Village, at the Hilton, the old Hilton Hawaiian Village, taught me how to play ukulele, and so I had a background, a basis for guitar because of that. I had an uncle who wasn't really an uncle, but a family friend who you'd call uncle, and he had an old acoustic guitar, and I just found it fascinating with old steel strings on it, and I was quite young, but you know, when I guess you could say it really kicked in with the British invasion and the Beatles, you know, and preceding that, you know, the Beach Boys. But I really got the bug when the Beatles thing kicked in.
It's incredible how many guys of your generation saw the Beatles and they just made a left turn, you know. It's just incredible. So you go to Good Shepherd Catholic School.
Yeah.
Is that in Beverly Hills?
Yeah, it's right there. It's still there on Linden, just south of Wilshire.
And that's where you met Dino Martin. You're both in the second grade or so, is that right?
Exactly. 7 years old. There were a lot of famous people who had children in our school, you know, names like, you know, well, Hal Roach's children, the Pharaohs, you know, Mia, Tisa, Steffi, Prudy, they're all, Mia was a little older, she was not in grammar school when I went there, but the McDonald Careys, the Herschelts, the Hursts, the, you know, Jeannie Crane's kids.
I mean, it wasn't like today with paparazzi waiting outside school. Did these kids...
No.
I mean, was there attitude with all these famous people?
No, not at all, because we were so young. You know, when you're 6, 7, 8 years old, I mean, the attitude hasn't set in yet, if you will.
Yeah.
You're just a little kid, you know? And so the aspect of the celebrity It was different back then, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it seems like it. So were you best friends with Dino?
We were best friends.
And so at what age did the two of you start singing music together?
Well, it was right around the time of the British invasion. I learned how to play the guitar ultimately, and my dad bought me a Spanish-style guitar, and Dino had an acoustic guitar laying around the house, and I taught him some chords. And we would do simple songs, Chad and Jeremy kind of stuff, you know, stuff that was designed for two people and limited chord knowledge. And then there was an event. I'm giving you the real capsulized version.
Okay.
Then we went electric. and we were both playing six string. And I had a very inexpensive guitar that my dad, we went down to like downtown LA to like a pawn shop and got, you know, it was new, but it was not a Fender or Gibson. It was like, it looked like kind of like a Fender Jaguar, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, my dad wasn't willing to spend big money for a really expensive guitar.
Right.
At that time. So I had that, Dino had that, we learned some more songs, and then there was some event at school that was going on, and we realized, you know, what we really need is a drummer. And we knew Desi could drum. He had set up his drums, and he would, when he first came to school, he did a little seminar. He would go around each of the classrooms and set up and perform a little drum show. He'd do a little drum show, you know, like a solo show, and you know, look at our talented classmate, you know, look at our talented students, Jesse, you know. And his sister was in our class, and we didn't pay much attention to Desi, you know. I mean,
because he was younger,
exactly.
Yeah,
and you know how it is.
Yeah, sure.
But we were impressed, and so we turned to Desi to be in our group, and we asked him out there on the, at the basketball standard out there in the playground one day if he'd be our drummer, and he said sure. And so that was that. But Dino and I still were on six string guitar. It wasn't for a while that until Dino actually learned how to play the bass and we became a proper trio, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Guitar, bass, drums. So
how good a drummer was Desi?
Excellent. Just excellent. And he was just a kid, you know.
Yeah. But how many years younger than you guys was Desi?
Roughly a year and a half, 2 years.
Okay. Which is a long time when you're, you know, 12.
Exactly.
Yeah. He's a little kid. So you guys are rehearsing, I think, in Lucille Ball's house and in the Dean Martin house as well, right?
Yeah, you've done your research, I can see. Yeah, we started at Lucy's. They had like a converted garage. Well, they had a multiple car garage set up at Lucy's house on Beverly Hills, and one of the garages was turned into like a playroom, like a, you know, a place where the kids could go and put on little shows, and you know, had a little itty bitty stage of a riser of a stage, and we started there. But I guess you could say we outgrew it. But we did start there. And speaking of Chad and Jeremy, coming full circle back to them, they showed up one day because they were in L.A. because they were going to do a series of shows in L.A. like the Dean Martin show, and they might have. Yeah, I think they did the Lucy show at the time, and those were the first of the British invasion people that I ever met, and that was a thrill. And it's funny because Desi has a theater in Boulder City, which is near where I live. I live in Vegas, not Vegas proper, but Henderson. And Chad and Jeremy are going to be playing at Desi's theater. Isn't that crazy after all these years?
Wow, the circle keeps going round.
Yeah.
So was it at all bizarre? This is, you know, I live Lucy's house, you know, and this is Dean Martin's house. Or was it just business as usual in Beverly Hills?
Well, in the case of Dean, his being just growing up and spending so much time with Dino at his house, I had sort of gotten acclimated to the fact that, oh, that's Dean Martin, though I was, you know, in awe of him a little bit. You know, I'd seen him on TV. I knew he was very famous. I knew, you know, a bit about him even at that early age. And so, but I tell you, going to Lucille Ball's house, that was something else, because she was on TV every day, and it was, I love Lucy, and oh my God, it's Lucy. You know, I mean, not to diminish Dean's importance at all, but I mean, Lucille Ball was like in a whole nother league. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, in the same, you know, in a very high caliber of celebrity, but she was quite special. And going to her house for the first time and meeting her for the first time was quite special, because at that point now I'm like 12 years old, you know, and so I'm older and I understand more, a little bit more about this concept of celebrity and her importance.
Yeah.
You know? When you're just a kid, you don't realize the importance of these people so much as when you get older, right?
Yeah. So how often did the band rehearse?
quite often.
And would you say they were good?
Yeah, and we just kept getting better and better. Well, yeah. You know, and I said we outgrew Lucy's and we moved to the Martin's house to expand our you know, our show and our just a little bit more room to move around, because they had a room that had a slightly larger area where we could work. It was like the den, you know, which was a pool room, which was the movie room. They had a theater, you know, the screen dropped
out. It sounds fabulous.
Yeah, it was. It was great. And yeah, of course.
And so what kind of gigs were you guys doing?
Well, one of the first gigs we were hired to do was at Rory Calhoun, who was an actor, his daughter's birthday party. I believe it was, you know, in his backyard. He lived right down the street from Lucy. Right, he was at Sunset in Roxbury. She was like a block up at Lexington in Roxbury. So we just set up in the backyard and played our handful of songs, because we only knew maybe 5-6 songs, and we just do them over and over. And I think we made $20.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, how are we going to split this three ways?
Give Desi less. Yeah. Dollar less. So that went on for a little while, and then we sort of cut to the scene that you discussed earlier, where, you know, an audition is set up in the Martin's house, and
yeah.
Frank Sinatra comes over and goes, hey, kids, be on my label, just like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, he and Dean were there, sitting at the bar. Old blue eyes and old red eyes, I like to say. Thank you. And we did our little, you know, 3-4 songs.
Right.
Dino still, both of us still on the 6-string guitar, electric, playing through one amp. I mean, I'm sure it was just god-awful. I mean, these are a couple of guys that, you know, of course, now that I'm older and have an appreciation of just how important Frank Sinatra was, and Dean Martin, of course. I'm sure, you know, it was probably, it wasn't probably their cup of tea as far as music, but, you know, I think Frank saw the potential, and of course it's his friend's kid, and
why not?
Lucy's kid, and sounds like maybe, you know, something could happen here, you know?
Yeah, well, I always feel that, you know, like a lot of guys of that other generation, Dean and Frank, when rock and roll first came, they did not like it. They said it would never last, and they sort of gradually warmed up to it and sort of had some fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure they exactly understood it ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's funny that Frank Sinatra's an A&R guy for a rock, you know, signing rock bands.
Well, he did end up doing, you know, Elvis was on his show.
Right.
And as you say, we warmed up to it. But, I mean, they were, you know, they never sang it themselves, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They stuck to what they did, and the rockers did what they did, you know, so.
You end up getting produced by Jimmy Bowen and then eventually Lee Hazelwood.
Yeah.
Some great arrangers, Jack Nitzsche and Billy Strange, and guys like Bones Howe working on the sessions.
Uh-huh.
So you're in very capable hands behind the board. Was your first trip to the studio, was it scary? Were you guys ready? What was the
deal?
Well,
it's funny because we met with Jimmy, who was a great guy, and we picked, they brought a couple of songs for us, you know, on demos, for us to consider, like, wouldn't this be, you know, would you like this song? Would you like to record this song? And I was like, okay. And, like, I think that we were told, well, you know, the Beatles took a pass on this one. Well, that's all we needed to hear. The Beatles had even heard it, you know. I don't know whether that was true or not, but, I mean, let's assume it was true. So it's a song called We Know. And then I had heard a song, I think it was on a Searchers album, called Since You Broke My Heart. And years later, I realized, because at the time I wasn't looking at writers and who wrote what, or I just liked the song, and it turned out it was written by, I think it was Phil Everly.
Hmm, right.
Yeah. And anyway, we recorded those two songs, but when I say we recorded them, it wasn't quite like that. We were told that... we were invited to the session, but we wouldn't be playing on it.
That was a question I had. You know, it's famous that the Wrecking Crew guys sort of came in there and played, but you were invited. You didn't just come and sing.
Well, we were shocked. We were shocked to hear that we weren't playing.
Ah.
completely took us by surprise. Didn't know that's how the game worked. Thought we'd be playing on it ourselves.
Kind of hurt. Did you protest? Did you cry?
Pardon?
Did you protest or cry or?
Well, yeah, we kind of squawked a little bit, but it was like, well, this is the way it's done, you know. Okay, so we went to the session, the tracking session. Jerry Cole, I remember, was the guitarist. I do not remember who the drummer or the bass player were on that first, from those first two sides. And then we sang the vocals. But what was really awful was that they put some older guys' voices like in the background, like, you know, like the response, like to our young voices. The line was something like the bridge. People may say that we're falling in love, but how do they know? And then these older voices, how do they know? It was like, who are those guys? It was like, what happened?
Puberty, yeah.
What happened here, you know? Where did we lose control of this? Well, we never really had control of it, I guess you could say. And anyway, we did the Hollywood Palace. We did Since You Broke My Heart. Tony Martin was the host. His son ended up being friends of ours in later years. But the song went nowhere. And so back into the studio, back to the drawing board, which I like to point out to people who say, well, you guys had it handed to you, and it was, you know, the point is that you can't make people buy, you know, your product, no matter what your name is or what your background is, you see. And they liked I'm a Fool, which was our next song, which was produced hands-on, you know, by Lee Hazelwood. I think Jimmy stepped back and turned it over to Lee. Jimmy supervised the session, but Lee was in control, you know. And
that was a big, I think, number 17, you know, top 20 hit, 1965, you know, right on the charts there next to the Beatles and everything. A big song. Put you guys on the Ed Sullivan Show, Shindig, Hullabaloo, Lloyd Thaxton Show, American Bandstand, Where the Action Is, Mike Douglas, Joey Bishop.
Shindig.
Everything, right. I mean, was that, now was your mind blown? I mean, here you are.
Yes,
you're
now 14. We're having some fun.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the experience of doing the Hollywood Palace was incredible. Mind you, that was 64, and it was still black and white television, if you can imagine. You know, color TV didn't kick in until 65, you know. And so we had a taste for it, and then, oh, nothing, you know. So it was disheartening. But then when I'm a Fool hit, it was like, wow. This is great. This is really great.
Being a rock star. Did those Wrecking Crew guys, did they treat you nice? Did they
totally
ignore you?
Totally nice.
Yeah.
Totally nice. Yeah, because they thought we were cute, and we were. And we really respected them and their craft. I mean, to walk into a session and see Earl Palmer and Ray Pullman and Carol Kaye and Hal Blaine and all those people, it was pretty intense because shortly thereafter, we opened for the Beach Boys at the Hollywood Bowl on the heels of the success of I'm a Fool. So this is July of 65, and the Beach Boys liked us a lot. It was a big summer spectacular. Righteous Brothers, Byrds, Sonny and Cher, Kinks, and us, and a few others that I'm forgetting. And we went to Bakersfield, Fresno, and Hawaii. It was the tour with them, and then ultimately my
Amazing.
Sister Annie married Carl Wilson. So not only was I seeing the Wrecking Crew guys at Dino Desi's and Billy sessions, but I was seeing them at the Beach Boys sessions that I would attend with Carl, you see.
So the Beach Boys, you open for them at Hollywood Bowl, and it really opens, I mean, changes the direction of your life, really, forever.
Yeah.
You become a member of the Beach Boys family, literally and figuratively, you know, and to this day, really. So your sister marries Carl Wilson.
Yeah.
You guys go on tour with them, including going to Hawaii, which must have been a riot.
It was great.
And you're still a kid, really.
I am 14.
Yeah, amazing. You play harmonica on Beach Boys Party, and they even call out your name before.
Yeah, go Billy. Oh, yeah.
And along the line, you sing on, at least, I believe, studio version of Darlin', Heroes and Villains, and Sail on Sailor, and your guitar is sprinkled throughout the years over many, many Beach Boys albums.
Yeah, actually,
you there?
Holland. Just if we want to keep the record straight.
I'm sorry, you dropped out just for a minute there.
Oh, I was saying I didn't really work on Sailor, the studio version, but I did work on Funky Pretty, both of which were on the Holland album.
You don't sing on Sail on Sailor?
Well, I don't think so. Do I get a credit on it? If I got the credit, then yeah.
You're in the liner notes of the reissue, but it's so hard, you know, nobody really remembers, I think. It's hard.
Yeah, it's funny because they're re-releasing Dennis Wilson's Pacific Ocean Blue, and on the original, I was credited with a few things, mostly vocals, but I actually played on the River Song. I played guitar on it, but wasn't credited. But then with the reissue, and of course they're going through the archives and everything, it turns out that I sang or played on like three or four other songs that weren't originally credited. But so they'll, I'm sure, get that straightened out. I'm real excited about that. I just heard it yesterday, and also the second CD, Bamboo, with the bonus tracks, but we're probably getting ahead of the story here.
sort of. Dino, Dizzy, and Billy stopped playing together. They ended up making four albums, had a couple of hits, a bunch of singles.
Yeah.
You parted ways with Reprise, made a couple more singles, and then you guys sort of went your separate ways. Literally, you just grew out of it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was a one-year period we were with CBS. Desi and I were just talking about this, and they released a few songs. And then we went back to Reprise for about a year, and Dino recorded a solo song, and I recorded a solo song. And then that was just pretty much it. You know, they didn't pick up the options, and, you know, I was getting more active with the Beach Boys. Dino wanted to act, and Desi wanted to, well, act also. Dino wanted to do a lot of things, which he ended up doing. But, yeah, it just sort of run its course.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a 4 or 5 year run there.
Not bad, yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys were ready for a new direction, I think. You stayed in school, UCLA's Motion Picture Television Division, got your degree, but in and out of the Beach Boys family, like I say. Let's talk about Dino for a couple minutes. He seemed like a totally charismatic guy, passed away in 1987 in an airplane accident.
Yeah.
He was a football player, was a medical, you know, studying to be a doctor.
I lost you there. You said he was a football player.
Right. He studied medicine. He married two gorgeous women. He flew jets. He acted. He sang.
Yeah.
Was he just a ball of energy?
Yeah. He was just one of those kinds of people that, obviously he wanted to do a lot of different things in his life. And when he, you know, after the Dino, Dizzy, and Billy thing, he started to explore all these other areas. He was a mature guy, you know, for his age. I guess you could say we all were, having been exposed to all this stuff at such an early age. But Dino, he just was intense, you know. He was very good at the things that he did. I mean, he achieved, he accomplished. You know, he was a great athlete. He learned to fly a helicopter and then airplanes and then jets. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it is amazing. And, yeah, he tried pre-med for a year, but, you know, that's a tough one. And he even played football here in Vegas. He played for the Las Vegas Casinos, I think the team was called.
Yeah.
Something like that. Until some guy, you know, blindsided him, knocked him unconscious during a play, and he said, okay, that's it, I better just stick with tennis.
I'll just be great at tennis.
Yeah. And he was a great tennis player, too. I mean, you know, amazing. He was an amazing guy.
So you finally graduate from UCLA and basically get membership as a touring member of the Beach Boys.
Though I had been offered membership years earlier, the guys came to the house and offered me basically a full membership. But it was one of those things where I said yes, but it was a shaky time for the Beach Boys. And I guess one of the reasons they wanted to hire me to replace Bruce, so they told me. And, you know, Bruce was eventually phased out, and Blondie Chaplin and Ricky Fattar came in, if you know the Beach Boys a little bit. But, you know, my dad in particular wanted me to finish school, and I did that. So, I used 1974 as the year I joined, only because it was the year I was put on retainer. So it sort of made it feel a little bit more
official,
even though all the years in college, I was still touring with them.
Right.
You know what I mean,
it's interesting. Over the years, you know, there's pictures of you playing almost every instrument you can play in the Beach
yes.
Boys. Some tours, you're the bass player, the guitar player, the keyboard player.
Yeah.
The tambourine player, whatever it is. We heard a song earlier from the Beach Boys in Concert record, which is such a great record. We heard the version of Heroes and Villains, which I think you're on most of that album.
Yeah,
it's
I am.
Really?
I have a gold record right here on my wall, my first gold record and my proudest gold record.
Oh, that's nice. It's a great record. I love
it
that
is.
Record. Yeah. The drumming on it, which I guess is Ricky Fitar, is crazy good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What were those years like? I mean, the Beach Boys went from sort of losing their identity a little bit, you know, from the hippies and, you know, they were square, I guess.
Right.
And it took them a little while to sort of get their thing back, partly, I think, going to England where they were so revered.
Uh-huh.
And then they became, you know, they regrew their thing to where they were really as big a touring band as you could be, playing giant, giant stadiums.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much to read about the Beach Boys. It seems like, in some ways, a dysfunctional family, well, just like any family.
Yeah.
But they were literally a family and also, you know, just the pressures of being in a group together. Was it hard for you to stay out of the middle of that, or were you in the middle of it?
No, I think I stayed out of it as much as I could. I mean, as far as the business aspect of it, you know, I never sat in on any corporate meetings or anything. I wasn't a corporate member, you know. It was the three Wilsons, Mike and Al, you know, and that was that. But yeah, there were politics for sure, you know, and even though I respected all the guys, of course, you know, I was more inclined to be a Wilson person than anything else. You know what I mean?
Certainly your sister was married to Carl. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, do the guys get along, or are they taking five separate buses around? How did it work?
Well, there was a time when there was separate transportation, you know, one plane for this crowd and another plane for the other half of the band. Yeah, it was like that for a little while, you know. It's the group's been through a lot of phases.
Yeah, it really has. And it seems like the true story really hasn't quite been told yet.
I don't know if it can be.
Yeah.
Somebody said, oh, sure it can. Well, I don't know. Because it's not only is it 40 years... and 40 years plus, but it's ongoing.
Yes.
It's not over.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see everyone get back at least to be in the same room once or twice and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you have played with the Beach Boys on and off for how long? I mean,
well, I say 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah, but you're still playing with Al Jardine's band and with Brian Wilson's band, right?
Isn't that something?
That is something.
I'm proud to say that when Carl went solo, I was the only band member that he brought with him, you know, to be in his solo band.
Yeah, in the 80s, Carl went solo. I think that was a pretty dark time for Carl, from what I read.
Well, not on the road. We, you know, it was all very business, you know. Let's get the show done. And not that Carl didn't have, you know, some rough patches, but that period of time he was great, touring and, you know, doing the albums and stuff, and that was wonderful.
There's some great footage on the web, on YouTube, of you and various Beach Boys. There's you rapping during the Pipeline Wipeout.
Yes,
yeah, wearing your gold lamé jacket during Wipeout. And there's some great footage of you playing electric piano. I think it's Catch a Wave, you know, and the band is just so simple, you know. You can sort of hear what everybody's doing, and it really moves great. Was the band, I mean, were there periods where you felt the band was much better than other periods?
Boy, oh boy.
And those parts, those harmony parts are so hard. I often wonder, with so many guys on stage, were guys hitting it, or was it just everybody sing something and it will happen?
Well, let's see, your first question.
Like 10 questions in one.
I'm looking at this gold record. That was a darn good band,
okay.
The one that did the concert.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Ricky Fitar, Carly Munoz, Ed Carter, myself. That was a darn... And at that time, Blondie was also performing, if I'm not mistaken.
In any case, it must have been fun to go up and do 2 hours of songs that everybody loves and knows, you know?
Absolutely, and I never
get tired of that.
Tired of doing those songs, because it's always a little bit different. And
Yeah, my guest is Billy Hinchey, member of the Beach Boys for 30-plus years, certainly the Beach Boys family, maybe for 40 years, I think we could say.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, from Dino, Desi, and Billy. Tell me about writing songs with Orrin Hatch, conservative senator from Utah, right?
He's a great guy. Let's see, how did that happen? I was doing a benefit in Utah with Ricky Martin, who's Dino's younger brother, and Senator Hatch asked me if I would collaborate with him on some songs. He was a lyricist, and he needed music. And it turns out he's quite a prolific writer of books and of songs, mostly religious-oriented, spiritual-oriented songs. And so I said, sure. And so he would fax me lyrics, like, just about every day for a period of time. And I would scurry off to the studio. I was living out in the Palm Springs area and record. You know, I convinced him to try more diversified approaches to these songs other than just religious, gospel-type approaches. So I convinced him to let me do, like, a rhythm and blues, a rock and roll, a country. We even did a rap. And so, you know, he was really determined to get these songs done, and we did like six, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, interesting.
And he said, Billy, I played that rap for my son. He said, Dad, put that in your safe. Don't let anybody ever hear that, because if they ever hear that, they're going to run you out of town.
That's funny. You talked about Dino's brother, and you guys in 2002 started Ricky, Desi, and Billy with Ricky Martin.
Yeah.
Is that band still in existence?
Not really. We did a few shows here in Vegas and up at Desi's Theater, and it was fun, and we cut a couple of live albums. And, that was that. That sort of ran its course, too.
Okay. You've got two solo albums out, and I see they're both available on your website, BillyHinchey.com. You've also got a great MySpace, MySpace.com/BillyHinchey, which has some great tracks for folks
actually,
to listen
to. Actually, I have three solos.
Three solo albums.
Yeah, I did this one called Bay of Plenty, which was named after this beautiful place in New Zealand where I recorded it. It was at a private party at a yacht club. I was hired to play for my friend's 40th birthday, it was. And I said, I might as well record this. And these are all songs that I had written or co-written. I co-wrote a song called Lady Love with Brian Wilson. And but basically original material. There's that. There's Bay of Plenty. Then there's Mixed Messages, which is a double CD of all songs that I've written. And then most recently Live at the Cannery, which is a venue here in Vegas.
Right.
So. But, they're all there. I'm glad you like my website and my MySpace.
Yeah, I urge folks to check all of that out. How often are you playing with your band, and how often are you playing with Brian or with Al Jardine's band?
Well, I haven't done any more shows since September 3rd, 06. I did that solo thing. I toured with Brian for a month last summer, and I just did three shows with Al here in Las Vegas, and we have another show coming up in July in Minnesota, Stillwater, Minnesota. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. From the Dino, Desi, and Billy days, do you make money? Did you have fair contracts? It's all...
We sure did make money, but, I mean, just to give you an idea, our rate was 5%, 5 cents that we split, which was a standard rate.
Right.
Which is, you know, do the math, not very much, but we made money.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we made money.
Let's talk about the Dennis Wilson Forever DVD.
Yeah.
This is a full-length film, a documentary about Dennis that you've made.
Uh-huh.
What moved you to do this?
Boy, let's see. I had done something for Dennis. I had tried to write a song. Well, on Pacific Ocean Blue, Dennis was very close to my father. My father died in 76, and Dennis wrote a song called Farewell, My Friend, for my dad, who we all call Pop. And it's a beautiful song, if you're familiar with Pacific Ocean Blue. Are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Farewell, My Friend.
I actually have an 8-track of that album.
Oh, wow. So that song was written for my dad. Did you know that?
No.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we're doing this interview, if only to share this information. And so when Dennis died, it was very difficult for me, to put it mildly. And I began to write a song called One in a Million. I thought was a good title, and I could not finish the song. And so it was 20 years down the line, 83, 93, and 03. Yeah, I decided to finish it. There was a fan party, you might call it, for Dennis celebrating his life in Santa Monica at Shea J, and I decided to complete the song. And not only that, but I had footage that I had shot because I was a film student at UCLA, and I would bring my camera on the road and shoot footage, which would fulfill my courses, which my professors needed, you know, something from me to show I was, you know, projects. So my projects became Beach Boy documentaries. Hmm. You see what I mean? So I was able to fulfill my scholastic obligations and tour with the boys. Hmm. So,
great.
Yeah. So I had footage, black and white footage, and I took all the shots of Dennis that I could, and I made, you know, a little video, like a little music video of One in a Million coupled with this footage. And then I just, you know what, I don't know why I decided to start interviewing people about Dennis. I guess I thought, you know, that I wanted to do more, you know, that in a sense I couldn't do enough for Dennis because Dennis did so much for me. So for 3 years I interviewed people. You know, if they came through town, I would interview them, you know, people, performers that, you know, knew Dennis, or if I went to L.A. and there'd be a family function, I would, you know, interview some of the family. I got quite a few at a Christmas a couple of years ago, Carney, Wendy, and Diane Ravel, and, you know, who's one of the honeys. And anyway, so slowly I assembled it, this 3 years worth of interviews, and then I said, well, you know what, you might as well put it together. So I put it together and released it about 6 months ago, something like that, and it has been very well received, very well received. People seem to love it and have responded to it, and right now I'm working on one for Carl.
Oh, interesting. Great. Yeah, it seems like...
Because it's been 10 years, excuse me for interrupting, it's been 10 years since Carl's been gone, so there's a milestone year again here.
When Dennis passed away, I mean, he lived such a crazy life. It was sad, but when Carl passed away, it was somehow more, for me, it was more sad. It was just such a surprise and such a, what a beautiful voice, you know, what a, just a singular voice that guy had.
Yeah, for me, it was more of a shock that Dennis went because it was so sudden.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And he was so young.
I mean, it was over just in the blink of an eye, and he's gone, you know. And in such a way, you know, that, well, it's just hard to understand, to accept, and all that, you know. Yeah. With Carl, we knew he was sick, and so we all had a little bit of an opportunity to acclimate to that idea. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's sad. Well, I'm going to wrap this up. I've got a song queued up, Music is Freedom.
Okay.
What a great track this is, and it's really just like, you know, could easily fit on any of the Beach Boys records of that late 60s, early 70s period.
Thank you. Well, I recorded it at Brian's house. That's Carl and I on guitar, Ed Carter on bass, Ricky Martin on drums.
Yeah.
Using the Beach Boys studio, well, Brian's studio at his home. The Beach Boys board, the big Moog synthesizer, using everything that they used to cut their album Surf's Up on, and many other songs as well.
And this came out. This was a 45.
Yeah, it came out in 70, 71, something like that. It was at the tail end of the Dino, Desi, and Billy thing.
Right. Well, that sounds about right. It's a fantastic track, and, you know,
it's
great to hear from you, and great that you're still making music and seem, you know, well-grounded through this giant, you know, step through rock history, you know.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I invite all your listeners to go visit my website, billyhinchey.com, or MySpace, Billy Hinchey.
Yeah, I'm sure they will do that. You know, and we'll all come see you next time we're in Vegas or next time you come through New York. You know, look us up. Come by, bring your guitar to the studio.
I'll do that.
All right, Billy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
the three.